We're going to think this morning about why does God allow suffering? Well, maybe you could ask the question, what kind of God allows suffering? Why is there suffering in the world? Why is it when God is God and can do whatever he pleases, why is there suffering in this world? What kind of God allows suffering? Well, let's lay down some markers. Number one, God has a plan. What happens to you and me and everyone doesn't just happen. There is a reason. And the reason, says the Bible, is God's plan. And everything that happens in this universe happens just as God has planned it. So Paul writes to the Ephesians, he says, according to the purpose of him who works all things, according to the counsel of his will. The second thing to say is this. God has a big plan. God's control extends over the whole universe. Psalm 135, whatever the Lord pleases, he does. He's accountable to no one. Daniel chapter 4, he does according to his will. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? He's accountable to no one. He's God. He really is God. And says the Bible, he's in control of the natural world. He's in control of the nations. He's in control of the free actions of men and women, boys and girls. And God is in control of every detail of your life and my life. Now, if you're on your way home and you lost 50 quid, you might tell someone, wouldn't you? 50 quid! But if on your way home you lost one of the hairs of your head, would you tell anyone? Well, it depends how many hairs you had before you set off at home. But a single hair, it's trivial, isn't it? But, says Jesus, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Even the loss of one hair is under God's control. So God has a plan. God has a big plan. It covers everything. So number three, what about free will? Does God's control eliminate our freedom? No, says the Bible. We're not pieces on a chessboard. So while I'm not free to choose anything outside of God's plan, my choices are nevertheless real, with real consequences, for which I will be held responsible. Which, of course, is why when I sin, I can't blame God. God's not the author of my sin. He's not the approver of my sin. He doesn't encourage or lead me into sin. But my sin nevertheless is in God's plan. But though my choices are in God's plan, God has planned that those choices really are free choices. So it's God's plan that guarantees that the choices I make are my free choices. It doesn't exclude my choice, it guarantees my choice. Because that's the plan, that my choices really will be free. So think of Jonah. He runs from God, takes a ship to Tarshish. God sends a storm. And to pacify the sea, the sailors throw Jonah overboard. And Jonah 1 verse 15 says, so they picked up Jonah and threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. So who threw Jonah into the sea? The sailors. But then 5 verses later, Jonah says to God, you cast me into the sea. So which was it? Who did throw him into the sea? Was it the sailors or was it the Lord? And of course the answer is both are true. The sailors' real choices, free choices, with real consequences, were nevertheless fulfilling the plan of God. On this piece of paper, I have an ant. The ant, he walks where he chooses. But by turning the paper, he walks where I choose. So his actions are free. No one's forcing the ant. He goes where he will. And yet by turning the paper, he fulfills my will. So God has a plan. It's a big plan. And it's a plan that doesn't eliminate our freedoms. But, and this is now we're getting to the meat of the sermon, if God is in control of everything, if the big plan extends over all things, what kind of God is he to allow suffering in the world? If he is in charge, why do bad things happen? And we'll deal with the question through the experience of one man. A man who asked this very question. His name is Job. So please come with me to the reading which we had. Job 38 and verse 39. Now Job's a believer. He knows all about suffering. You know the story, and one day he loses everything. He loses his property, his wealth, his standing, his servants, and perhaps the most crushing thing of all, he loses his children. It's unthinkable, isn't it? And later on, he loses his health. And Job is more than heartbroken. He is in agony. In the early chapters, when he begins to speak, it's just one long, articulate scream in which Job says, I wish I'd never been born. I want to die. This man loses everything. And to cap it all, this is innocent suffering. Says who? Says God. Job suffers not because he's guilty. He suffers because he's innocent. He suffers not because he's unrighteous. Quite the reverse. He's suffering because he is righteous. And Job knows it. He says to his accusing friends, he says, of course I'm a sinner, we're all sinners, but not in a way that explains this. Why am I suffering when I've done nothing wrong? He was the one man in all the world who was concerned to avoid offending God. And says Job in chapter 9, he says, living in God's world is like living in a police state. There you are, you're driving along at 30 miles an hour, minding your own business, not doing any harm. The police pull you over. They go through the car. And when they find something, maybe it's just an empty washer bottle, they throw the book at you. Says Job, that's what God is like. He can always find something to pin on you. He can always find something to make you suffer. Of course, because he's God, there's no comeback. In fact, Job goes even further. Maybe later, have a look at it. Chapter 16, he actually accuses God of murdering him. And the language he uses is brutal. That God lay in wait for him. And when he was walking past, God jumped out on him and slayed him. What kind of God is that? What kind of God allows suffering in the world? And as you go through Job, what Job wants, he wants his day in court because he feels this is unjust and he wants justice. And of course, if he wants his day in court, who does he want standing in the dock? He wants God in the dock. He wants God to come and explain and to justify what he has done. He wants God to ask the question. Why do you allow all of this to take place? If you read Job, it's strong stuff, it's thrilling stuff. But it's spoken by a man who suffered more than any of us here. Well, at last, in the book, God appears. Does God stand in the dock? Does God come to answer the charges? No. God comes to ask the questions. And as we've seen as we come to this passage. God is asking Job questions. Some of them are difficult questions. They're questions involving hard decisions. Hard decisions about suffering. Decisions about the morality and the purpose of suffering. And God is saying to Job this, before you point the finger at me, how would you deal with these issues, Job? You know, you've got lots to say about suffering. Well, Job, how competent are you to judge what is right and what is wrong? How competent are you to handle things of good and evil? So have those verses open in front of you as we seek to answer the question, what kind of God allows suffering? And it's really Job's moral maze. You may have heard, listened to the radio program, The Moral Maze. Well, this is Job's moral maze. So as we go through them, think about it. Think what's the question behind what God is saying. It's not just a description of animals. If you look at it, it's question after question. It's being loaded with something all the way through. So let's look at these questions which God sets to Job. And the first of all is a question about the eater and the eaten. So chapter 38, verse 39, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Who provides food for the ravens when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Okay, Job, whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the lioness who must feed her cubs? Or are you on the side of her prey? Whose side are you on? You decide who should live and who should die. As is God the raven, this big black member of the crow family. What does a raven feed on? It feeds on dead animals. And of course, if there are no dead animals, then its helpless nestlings will die. So come on, Job. Question about suffering. Should the antelope live and the lion cubs starve? Should the nestlings feed on the death of another, or should that other live and the nestlings starve? Whose side are you on? Come on, Job, you decide. After all, God is making these decisions all of the time. That's why Jesus says, Luke 12, God feeds the ravens. Question number two, or point number two, a question about parenting. Look at verse chapter 39. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy, they grow strong with grain. It's all going so well, isn't it? Then the last part of the verse says, they depart and do not return to them. There's the mountain goat, the mother carrying her young for months. And then she goes through all the strain of giving birth. Carrying her young, giving birth, it involves suffering, doesn't it? And then, in no time at all, her young leave her, never to return. You think, oh, all that the mother has done for them, and then they just go. And she never sees them again. Shouldn't they stay with their mother a bit longer? Or at least sort of stay around home so she sees them from time to time. Should they be allowed to go and never come back? Number three, a question about usefulness. Got two animals here, the wild donkey called the onager and the wild ox. Verse 5, who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager? Whose home I have made the wilderness and the barren land is dwelling. He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. That's someone trying to control him. The range of the mountains is his pasture and he searches after every green thing. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Or will he plough the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? See the question? These two animals, all that power that they've got, this wild donkey, this wild ox, so much strength, so much power, but you can't use it because you can't trust them. These two strong animals, they won't be tamed, they won't be domesticated. So you can see the dilemma. Should God take away their freedom? Because then they'll be useful. Should they be chained up and useful? But then if they're chained up and useful, that involves suffering because they lose their freedom. So which should it be? Are we going to chain them and they're useful? Or are they going to be free and no use to anyone? What would you choose? Which is right? You decide. You organize their lifestyle. After all, says God to Job, you've got a lot to say about how things ought to be run. Okay, number four, a question about pride and stupidity. Verse 13, the wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly storks? She leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they weren't hers. Her labor is in vain without concern. And the reason? Because God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. Says God, look at the ostrich. You know, there it is waving its feathers like some exotic dancer. But she doesn't use her wings, doesn't use her pinions in a kindly, loving way. She doesn't use them to protect her eggs or to guard her chicks. She leaves her eggs on the ground where they can be trodden on. And she apparently, if you watch her, treats her young harshly. More suffering. Now, why does she do that? Well, the answer is because God has made her stupid. God thinks I'll make a bird that's a stupid bird. So she can outrun the hunter, but she can't keep her own eggs safe. So should God give her more sense so she cares better for her young? But then if she cares better for her young, she's then more vulnerable to the hunter. And if she's more vulnerable to the hunter, that means more suffering. Or maybe God should give her bigger wings so she can fly and make her nest in the trees. But then if she flies and makes her nest in the trees, she won't be an ostrich, will she? And you'll never have seen an ostrich. So what would you... Is it better to have a sort of... a proud, stupid, carefree ostrich, and we all see the ostrich, but then her eggs are vulnerable? What would you do? And then number five, a question of power. And God is speaking about the war horse, and it's wonderful poetry, this, isn't it? Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and the javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage. Nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, "Aha!" He smells a battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. I don't know if any of us have seen a war horse. I haven't. But the description there, this horse is so powerful and fearless and frightening and aggressive. And there's something of a swagger and arrogance about this animal, isn't there? Which, of course, means he's so difficult to control. And once his blood's up, nothing you can do can stop him. Verse 25, at the blast of the trumpet, he says, aha, he smells the battle from afar. Once he knows the battle's on, you can't, he's gone, he's off. So what should we do with our war horse? Shall we tone him down? Should we make him a bit gentler? Sort of user-friendly, a bit more child-orientated? Should we have him so he can give children rides across the sands? Be a lot less trouble for us, wouldn't it? In fact, he'd be lovely, such a horse. All the children could come round him, but he'd be no good as a war horse. He'd be great in peacetime, but he'd be useless in war. So you can have 9 years of peace and tranquility and ease. And of course, on the 10th year, when you really need him, he's not there. And we all suffer. Or you can have 9 years of trouble, because he's this up-for-a-fight war horse, and that trouble involves 9 years, therefore, of suffering and of hardship, of having to try to control him and put up with him. But then how thankful you are, year 10, that when the war comes, he can ride to your rescue and save us all from suffering. Which would you rather have? Well, number six. A question of suffering, or maybe it's a question of serenity. In fact, we'll take it from verse 27. Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey. Its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. So we've seen an eagle soaring. It's a beautiful sight, isn't it? A master of all it surveys. And its home is an impregnable fortress up in the mountain. But what's it doing? It's looking for prey. Verse 30, its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. So you can see the question, can't you? Job, do you want bunny rabbits to live in safety and to die in peace? Or do you want to see an eagle soar? Which do you want? Because if you want to see eagles soar and be wowed by them, it means bunny's going to get it. So which do you want? Benjamin Bunny to live and no eagles, or Benjamin Bunny to die, but you've seen an eagle? You decide. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? You tell me what to do, Job? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. Job, you find fault in my dealings with you. You're asking this question, what sort of God are you to allow me to suffer like this? And you believe, Job, that I've got a case to answer. And you want me to come and take my place in the dock and to explain myself. You've got all these questions for me. Questions about justice and suffering and right and wrong. And you're saying, God, you take the dock. I've got questions for you. You answer me. Well, says God, Job, you answer me these questions first. Not the big questions, not the moral government of the universe. Job, I'm just going to give you a few easy questions, a few starters for 10. You know, Job, who should live and who should die? Whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the lions or on the side of their prey? Which one is going to suffer, the lions or their prey? And what are you going to do about those mountain goats? You know, all that suffering that their mother goes through, and then their offspring just abandon them, just like that, after all that they've done. And what did Job be going to do about the wild donkey and the wild ox? Should they be free? Freedom? But utterly useless? Or are you going to chain them and domesticate them? Which means suffering. But they will be useful. And what would you do with the ostrich? You're going to make her wiser, but then she's going to be more vulnerable to suffering. Or are you going to give her bigger wings, but then she wouldn't be an ostrich? And what about the war horse? All that power, but mixed with this arrogance and fierceness. So hard to handle in peacetime, but how thankful we are when the war comes. And the eagle. Would we have been better off never ever to have seen an eagle? There'd be less suffering, less bloodshed. Job, what do you think? What do we think? Is God wrong to make these creatures? Is he wrong to make these creatures and endow them with qualities that necessitate suffering? Can we navigate the moral maze? Can we run the universe better than God can? Would life be better if you and I were in charge? If you and I were making these decisions? Do you see? Through these simple questions, you see what God is saying to Job. Not just saying to Job, saying to us. He's saying this is a world of suffering, where suffering serves a wider purpose, where of necessity, if one lives, another dies. And Job gets it, doesn't he? Look at verse 3 of chapter 40. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. I'm not going to say anything more. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further." The man who's experienced suffering at God's hand more than any of us here, he's beginning to see a bigger picture. The moral maze doesn't end at Job's front door. There's a bigger picture, a bigger plan. And if Job can't explain the easy questions about suffering, if he can't handle the starters for 10, after all, none of us lose much sleep about whether or not an ostrich egg gets broken, do we? Why should Job then expect to understand God's purposes? Not just of his own suffering, but God's purposes for all suffering. What kind of God is he who allows suffering? Well, Job's jumped to a conclusion. He's demanded a response. But now having met God, now having been faced with just the simple questions about who shall live and who shall die, says Job, I didn't realize what I was talking about. And if you follow the book of Job, he discovers another answer to this question of suffering. Not in explanations, not in explanations that make sense to me. His answer is found in trusting the God of grace, the God of love, whose big plan is the best of all worlds. That's why, a little earlier in the book, Job 28:28, we read, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding." Job comes to discover that wisdom is not found in answers. We're brought up to think that, aren't we? If I have the answer, but actually here wisdom is found in fearing the God, trusting the God, loving the God who has the answers, who knows what he's doing. Well, let's try and draw it all together. What kind of God allows suffering? Why has God made us like he's made us? Why has God made you, you? Some people are ostrich-like, aren't they? They're proud and they're stupid. And they trample all over us. Some people are war horses. For 90% of the time, they're almost impossible to live with. And they're such hard work. But then when that 10% comes, you think, oh, that's why they're in this world. Some people are like the wild donkey. They're so strong, such capacity. They could be so useful, but you can never pin them down. You can't trust them. You can't rely on them. Some people like the young of the wild goat. You weigh yourself out helping them, and then they clear off without so much as a thank you. And we've probably got all those animals in Amien Park, haven't we? I mean, probably mixtures. But there are people in churches, and you think, why are they here? And then something crops up, you think, that's why they're here. And it might be hard living with them, but then when that situation comes up, they save us all. And that's why God has put them there. And you can you can talk about it over lunch and never think about what sort of animals we have here. But isn't it strange, isn't it? God has put us to get put us. And there are wonderful qualities in us. And in the same person, there are also destructive qualities. Wonderful qualities and destructive qualities in the same person. So, Christian friends, we can bless or we can destroy. And I'll just think about who I am, but why has God planned my life as he has? You know, we all confess there are some things which are my fault, aren't there? But not everything is my fault. And why has God planned my life to include suffering? And why are there situations where I have gained, but it's at someone else's expense? And then, of course, there are other situations where they've gained at my expense. And why do I have experiences I can never forget, and there are also experiences I want to forget? Why has God made a world of suffering? And like Job, we find ourselves in this moral maze. Well, the Bible tells us at the judgment, everything will be revealed. We'll recognize the perfect plan of the perfect shepherd. God will be vindicated. There is a wonderfully wise explanation to my suffering, to my trouble, to my trial, to my grief. A wonderfully wise explanation, but you need the mind of God to understand it. Only God can explain God. Only God understands God's ways. Because he's God. An infinite mind makes all the equations balance. Because it's an infinite mind. I have a finite mind. Of course the equations don't balance. The equations are too big for me. That's why Paul in Romans 11, he comes at the end of this great truth he's been unfolding, and he's just overwhelmed by the wisdom of God. He says, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. It's too much for a finite mind, too much for a little pitiable, sinful mind. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor, or who has first given to him that it should be repaid to him? Who's gone and given God advice? For of him and through him and to him are all things. To whom be glory forever and ever. That being so, it's not for me to start unpacking my life and saying, well, why this, why that, why this, why that. God will tell me. He will sit down with me. He will go through the story. I will see the way it's all weaved perfectly together. I will be able to trace that golden thread of his grace throughout. And actually, there were no mistakes. But for now, it's my business simply to trust and obey. To love and to worship the God I cannot explain. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. But of course, the book of Job is not God's last word on the subject. What kind of God is he? This is the God who entered our world as a man, who left his fingerprints on a cup, his footprints on the sand, who left his blood on the ground. He entered our world of suffering, and he suffered as no one has ever suffered. He became a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. So that whatever we go through, he has been there before, and worse. He knows what it's like. As Alan was telling us last Sunday morning, he knows what it's like to be me. We feel our sufferings are unique. Nobody understands. He understands. He knows what it's like to be me. He's been through much more, far worse. He's the God who sympathizes, the God who empathizes, the God who cannot but feel with us, for us, in it with us and for us. He's a God who knows, into whose kind arms we can fall, and who can therefore comfort us and help us and support us in our sufferings and sorrows as no other can. But God in Christ has gone further still. What did Job's moral maze teach us? That this is a world of suffering, where suffering serves a wider purpose. Where of necessity, if one lives, then another must die. And so Jesus Christ, the only true and perfect innocent, he became the greatest sufferer in the universe. And his suffering served the widest purpose of all. The redemption of the world and the end of all suffering. Where of necessity, if we are to live, if we are to be saved from sin and death and hell, then Jesus must die. And wicked men took him. And they nailed him to a cross. But it was all in the big plan. And there he suffered. But the real suffering was not the nails. The soul of his suffering was the suffering of his soul. That day when he who knew no sin was made to be sin. When he took his identity from sin. And he suffered all that sin deserves. The day when he bore the sin of the world in the presence of a holy God. And God did not spare his son. He banished him to the furthest edges of reality and beyond. To suffer under the curse of God. To burn in the fire of God. To be banished from the presence of God, where the only words of the greatest sufferer of all were, "Why? Why? My God, why have you forsaken me?" No one has ever suffered like Jesus. But his sufferings will gladden the eyes of God's people, world without end. What God has done through suffering. Because he suffered for us, for my sins. He dies that I might live. For Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. What God has done through suffering, it will be the theme of the ages. What he has done through an innocent, dying on a cross, it will be the song of heaven. Do you see? Maybe this morning you've entered here and your life you feel has been like a car crash. And everything's gone wrong. It's a mess. Well, don't hold your picture. Don't hold your phone and take a picture of yourself and say, "Well, why me?" The Bible says, turn to Jesus Christ. Begin there. Begin with the one who knows all about it, who knows what it's like being you. You're not going to shock him or surprise him. He knows everything about you. Come to him just as you are. Get yourself right with the one who has the plan. Has the plan for your life. And bow the knee. Lord, you died that I might live. He became a man of sorrows, that every tear might be wiped from my eye. Come to him, just as you are. I say, well, I don't know if I can believe in these things. Well, come to him and he'll give you faith to believe. You say, well, I don't know if I can leave my life the way it... Well, come to him and he'll give you a new life. But my heart is so filled with other things. Come to him and he'll pour himself into your life. And when his love strikes your heart, it will expel all other loves. And you'll find in him your all in all. But come to him. Lord, save me, forgive me, change me. What kind of God allows suffering in the world? The kind of God who sends his Son to suffer, to save the world. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life.